Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gregory Wilpert, author and co-founder of Venezuela Analysis, who assesses the legacy of the late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and his nation's future. Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, who talks about how austerity policies now being advocated in Washington disproportionately hurt women and other groups not fairly represented in the halls of power. And Craig Scott Roseborough, director of the new film Greedy Lying Bastards, who discusses his documentary's investigation into the power and influence of the fossil fuel industry on U.S. climate policy. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Afghan teenager Basha Zarino was collecting firewood when a drone missile struck and killed two Taliban commanders last fall. Shrapnel from the attack hit Zarina. She died while being rushed to a hospital a half an hour away. According to the Los Angeles Times, Zarina is one of the civilian victims of over 500 drone strikes in Afghanistan in 2012, an over 70% increase from the year before, as U.S. military commanders increasingly rely on unmanned aircraft to kill insurgents. The Pentagon is in the process of reducing the number of U.S. combat troops in Afghanistan in preparation for the major drawdown in 2014. Drone operations are increasingly controversial on Capitol Hill. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul delayed the confirmation of John Brennan, President Obama's nominee to head the CIA, with a rare old-style 13-hour filibuster. Paul and other legislators were concerned about the Obama administration's earlier refusal to rule out a drone strike against Americans on American soil. Under pressure, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder eventually ruled out such an attack on American territory if that person did not pose an imminent threat. Drone strikes, ordered by the executive branch with no known oversight or checks and balances, increasingly rely on intelligence signatures or subjective observations such as the movement of trucks or groups of armed men, rather than requiring positive identification of targeted individuals. During the recent debate, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said that an estimated 4,700 people have been killed in America's drone war over the last decade, the first time a government official has offered a total number of fatalities caused by drone strikes. With $85 billion in sequester cuts biting into the federal budget, House GOP leaders are looking to expand and deepen austerity policies by reviving Republican 2012 vice presidential candidate and House Budget Chief Paul Ryan's controversial plan to turn the Medicare program into a voucher system for the nation's senior citizens. According to the Los Angeles Times, seniors could buy private insurance or traditional government-paid Medicare under the proposal, and the changes would likely impact everyone younger than 56 years of age. Elements of the plan contradict the GOP pledge made during the 2012 presidential campaign not to change Medicare for today's seniors. Critics point out that with strict caps on funds available to pay for health care under Ryan's Medicare voucher program, the cost of Medicare would be shifted from the government onto seniors themselves. Ryan's new 10-year budget blueprint calls for a balanced budget, locking in $1.2 trillion in sequester-linked cuts over the next decade, while reducing the cost of Medicaid, the health program for the poor, disabled, and seniors in nursing homes, and slashing social safety net programs like food stamps and school lunches for poor children. Arizona day laborers won a major victory in the 9th District U.S. Court of Appeals, which upheld an injunction against a specific section of the state's immigration law, SB 1070, that prohibits people from stopping cars to hire day laborers if it creates a traffic jam. 9th District Federal Judge Raymond Fisher ruled that the language on day laborers and traffic seemed to be motivated by a desire to eliminate the livelihoods of undocumented immigrants. Pablo Alvarado of the National Day Labor Organizing Network hailed the ruling, declaring it is fundamentally wrong to criminalize work, to criminalize people who are looking for work to feed their families. Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn pledged to appeal the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, claiming the state legislature acted properly to protect the safety of drivers and pedestrians. Public nuisance and anti-loitering laws have often been used to marginalize poor communities and limit their access to the public square, and to provide authorities with an excuse to surveil and harass community organizers. Raul Alcaraz Ochoa of Tucson, Arizona's Southside Day Labor Center says, "The ruling shines a light on how profit and exploitation under capitalism are central to the national immigration debate." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
One of Latin America's most flamboyant and popular politicians, Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela, died on March 5th while recovering from cancer surgery in a military hospital in Caracas. Chavez, who lost his two-year battle with cancer, had just won a hard-fought re-election campaign in October, but was never sworn in to serve his fourth term. Chavez was remembered at a national funeral ceremony that attracted more than 30 leaders from around the world and over 2 million Venezuelans who waited in long lines to view his body lying in state. Before he left to undergo his fourth cancer surgery in Cuba in December, Mr. Chavez designated his vice president, Nicolas Maduro, to run as his party's candidate should a new election become necessary. With Chavez's death, that election is now scheduled for April 14th. Maduro will face opposition candidate Enrique Capriles, who lost to Chavez in last October's presidential election. Chavez will be remembered by millions of Venezuelans for his programs that effectively reduced poverty in his nation and for his defeat of a U.S.-supported military coup in April 2002. People across Latin America and the Caribbean will also remember Chavez for the institutions he founded, with the help of Venezuela's vast oil wealth, to establish the region's independence from U.S. power and influence. Your reporter spoke with Gregory Wilpert, a sociologist who lived and worked in Venezuela from 2000 to 2008, co-founder of the news website VenezuelaAnalysis.com, and author of the book Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, The History and Policies of the Chavez Government. Here he assesses the legacy of the late Venezuelan leader and the future of his Bolivarian 21st century socialist revolution.
Hugo Chavez created a more democratic and more egalitarian Venezuela in his 14 years in office. I think the essence of it. There are two areas that he really changed Venezuela, transformed Venezuela, and one is creating a more equal society. It had been previously one of the most income inequal countries of Latin America, and now it is, after Cuba, the second most income equal or egalitarian country of Latin America. So that's one major achievement. And the second one is to have introduced some measure of participatory democracy in Venezuela. Venezuela had been previously a very kind of, well, what political scientists call polyarchic democracy. That is, and this will sound familiar to most U.S. Americans, that was a political system where citizens could choose between two parties, between two sets of elites, basically. And participation was very low, apathy was very high, and this is the way that Venezuela looked very similar in that respect to the United States. And now it's completely different. There's many political parties all vying for office, and citizens are, participation is way up, and politicization is way up. There's very little political apathy anymore. And not only that, people feel like they have a real stake in their communities and in their local government through communal councils and through workplace self-management. So those are the two main realms, creating a participatory democracy and a more egalitarian society.
Gregory, I wondered if you would address some of the criticisms of the government of Hugo Chavez, including the fact that he was some kind of dictator. I heard one interesting comment on National Public Radio that discussed him as using democratic methods to undermine democracy. If you can unravel that, I think it's kind of interesting. Certainly, there were criticisms of Chavez's handling of the economy. There's fairly high inflation in Venezuela. People are saying that the deficit is a dangerous thing. High crime and murder rates in Caracas and throughout the country. There's often criticism, too, of the social programs, which many say are unsustainable, and the undermining of the oil industry.
Well, I mean, of all of those criticisms, I would pretty much dismiss the one about dictatorship or creating a dictatorship with democratic means or whatever that was, I pretty much would dismiss that. Well, then the ones that one can debate, I think, legitimately debate perhaps, are the ones around economic management. And those, to some extent, of course, depend on what your values are. That is, you know, the people who raise those concerns and criticisms often are people who basically don't believe in the kind of socialistic kinds of policies that the Chavez government has been following. I mean, just to address a couple of those points very quickly, I mean, the whole thing about inflation, for example, it's true that Venezuela has the highest inflation rate in the Western Hemisphere. On the other hand, the inflation rate during the Chavez presidency has been half as high as it was during the two previous presidents before Chavez. Venezuela has inherently, structurally, a very high inflation rate because it earns practically all of its foreign currency through dollars that are then converted into the local currency that ends up flooding the market and raising prices for everything. And then there's the other criticisms that I would say are perhaps much more legitimate, which are the criticisms about the high crime rate. That's certainly a problem, and the persistence of corruption is certainly a problem. I would say the Chavez government definitely has neglected for most of the 14 years that Chavez was in office, and only in the last 2 or 3 years really turned his attention to that problem, and awfully late. And part of the reason is that, you know, the government just basically assumed that crime would go down when poverty went down, and that just didn't happen. It was a mistaken assumption. As a matter of fact, crime to some extent got even worse, and which is, I think, partly actually a functioning of the increasing wealth of many people. That is, you know, there's more to steal in the end and more to fight about. So of course, one of the issues that Nicolas Maduro, the Chavez's successor, and probably who will probably be elected on April 14 when there's a new presidential election, he promised to pay special attention to the crime problem, and that's, of course, he knows that that is a sensitive issue.
Gregory, I also wanted to ask you about what, in your view, is the future of Chavez's United Socialist Party of Venezuela? There are many people, observers from outside, who really saw Hugo Chavez as the glue that held various interests together in that party. Without him there, do you think the United Socialist Party will continue on in a powerful position in the country?
I think Chavez was absolutely instrumental in bringing this coalition together and holding it together for a long time. But having that said that, I don't think it necessarily means that it's going to fall apart when he's gone. I used to believe that, actually. But seeing recent events and just seeing the whole situation since Chavez was diagnosed with cancer, I've seen actually relatively little infighting. And so I've had to reevaluate my analysis of that since then. And I think that actually they're probably going to hold together much better than most people assume. This, of course, doesn't mean that there's not going to be infighting. As a matter of fact, one could turn this argument about infighting around and say that it's actually a very positive development, given that under Chavez there was so much unity that it pretty much nipped any kind of debate in the bud. And so now, instead, you will have much more active debate, I think. And I think that's good. The people in the government know, or the different factions actually know, that the only way they're going to keep the revolution going, which they hold very dear, is by maintaining unity.
That was Gregory Wilpert, co-founder of the news website VenezuelaAnalysis.com and author of Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, The History and Policies of the Chavez Government. For more analysis and commentary on the legacy of Hugo Chavez and Venezuelan politics, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 8th, International Women's Day, National Organization for Women President Terry O'Neill released a statement criticizing governments around the world for balancing their budgets on the backs of women. She called on leaders in the United States to firmly reject austerity policies that have been economically devastating to women in Europe. She wrote, "Call it what you like, austerity, sequester, deficit reduction, I call it a stealth attack on women." O'Neill went on to assert that women, people of color, and individuals with disabilities, groups that disproportionately rely on social service programs, are sectors largely underrepresented in the halls of power and make easy scapegoats. She says that politicians proposing deep cuts to the nation's social safety net are willing to cut programs for the poor, given that they naturally want to protect the interests of big business and the wealthy contributors who fund their political campaigns. O'Neill points out that many conservative politicians, already predisposed to slash social programs, frequently use government debt as an excuse to cut even deeper. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with O'Neill about her concerns, including the fact that although men lost jobs at a higher rate than women at the beginning of the Great Recession, for the past few years, women, who make up a majority of teachers and other public sector workers, have suffered higher job losses than men. Here, O'Neill talks about growing economic inequality, the lack of proportional representation of women in Congress, and the need for members of the nation's emerging progressive majority to become actively engaged in holding politicians accountable for their stand on the issues.
As the gross domestic product of this country has gone up every year, the vast majority of that increase in GDP has gone to the very, very top income earners in this country. That would be the top 0.01% has skimmed off the lion's share of what ordinary people have made for the United States. And yet the regulations and laws of this country over a period of 30 years have moved exactly in that direction. And now the Republican Party, which is in the grip of radical extremists, they want to cut social spending, Head Start, after school programs, family planning clinics, other health care, a huge number of social welfare programs. The conservatives in Congress want to cut those programs. These disproportionately serve women because they disproportionately serve people who are responsible for kids. That would be women. And they disproportionately employ women, right, as social workers and case managers and teachers and nurses and home health care aides and licensed practical nurses and so forth. What the right wing is telling us, and the Republicans in charge of the House are telling us, is that somehow the country as a whole will thrive if these programs are cut. That's just wrong. What will make the country thrive is if we get jobs, put the women back to work, put the men back to work, allow people to work for livable wages, middle-class wages, good benefits, retirement security, and by the way, equal pay for work of equal value. If you put us back to work, then we'll have more income tax flowing into the federal treasury, and that's how you reduce the federal deficit in a humane way, not in a way that really devastates so many middle-class families.
Terry O'Neill, I know you said you watched Makers on public TV recently about the women's movement from the 1960s forward. Women were in the streets fighting for equal pay, reproductive rights, against violence. It's very historical, but what do you think will turn things around in the 21st century?
We have to get beyond 17, 18, 19% of the United States Congress. That's key. Women are under 20% of the U.S. Congress, less than 20% of governorships. We are only 3 out of 9 Supreme Court justices. We need to get a lot closer to half than what we are.
As was made apparent by that show, Makers, gender alone doesn't necessarily guarantee a progressive point of view, because they had a whole segment on Phyllis Schlafly and what an incredible organizer she was against the Equal Rights Amendment and other issues of concern to the women's movement.
Absolutely, and in fact, that's what I think is part of the genius, if I may, of the National Organization for Women. We are not the National Organization of Women. We've always had men in leadership positions. Since I've been active with the organization, I became active in the early to mid-1990s, and we've always had men on the national board. Now PAC endorses men who stand up for our issues. And by the way, it's really hard to get a Now endorsement, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. But we endorse women, obviously, and we really encourage women to run. We will endorse men who support our issues. But that said, it's also true, and I've seen studies to this effect, which I think are fascinating, that if you compare the policy vote of conservative women with those of equally conservative men, systematically the women vote in a way that actually is better for women overall than the conservative men do. And the same thing is true of moderate women and moderate men, and even liberal or progressive women and liberal or progressive men, that systematically you'll see more votes and more decisions that would be supported by the women's rights community of women, even across the political spectrum.
That's interesting. Is there anything else you think women and men need to do to make progress against this growing backlash against women?
Yeah, I think they need to become politically engaged. The demographics are on our side, right? The demographics that are growing in this country are as follows. single women. It's a growing political bloc. Latinos, Latinas, immigrants, communities of color generally, and younger people. Now, those are all very overlapping communities. But those are the demographics that are growing, and they very systematically prefer progressive policies over conservative ones. So what we need to do is engage, raise the awareness of these progressive citizens and get them engaged in the political process so that they vote, so that they contact their elected officials, so that they let their elected officials know, look, I'm watching, and I'd just as soon vote you out of office if you vote against my interests.
That was Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women. Learn more about NOW's ongoing campaign for gender equality and justice by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the current environment of the fiscal cliff and sequester program cuts, the $10 to $52 billion of taxpayer-funded subsidies received annually by the nation's largest oil and gas companies remains off the table and immune to cuts in congressional budget negotiations. With so many politicians' election campaigns being bankrolled by big oil, it's not hard to explain why the most profitable industry in the history of the planet still receives a fortune in government handouts. A similar display of the raw power of the fossil fuel industry can be seen in the decades-long deadlock on U.S. policy to address climate change. Apart from occasional political rhetoric about the threat of climate change, Washington has not initiated any credible initiatives to reduce the nation's carbon emissions linked to global warming. A new documentary film that investigates the power and influence of the fossil fuel industry exposes the funding provided by Big Oil to a network of climate change deniers who charge that global warming is a myth. The film Greedy Lying Bastards, directed by Craig Scott Roseborough and produced by actor and climate activist Daryl Hannah, illustrates a deliberate campaign of disinformation designed to confuse the public and create doubt about the need for government action to address climate change. Through interviews with climate scientists, astroturf activists funded by the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil, and people around the world whose lives have been devastated by floods, drought, and wildfires linked with rising temperatures, the film makes a powerful case for grassroots mobilization to challenge the power and influence of the fossil fuel industry. Your reporter spoke with Greedy Lying Bastards director Scott Roseborough, who talks about the film's message and how he hopes information presented in the documentary can be used as an organizing tool within the emerging international climate change movement.
You know, Scott, there's really two different categories of individuals that are that make up the climate change denial campaign. And that are the frontmen, you know, the people that we see on the likes of Fox News that are really spreading purposely the misinformation. And then there's the funders, where those guys are getting their money. And so they are working hand in hand and have been for a number of years now to ensure that we are confused about the issue and that our congressmen do pretty much nothing about it. So our all-time, you know, number one funder of climate change denialists in the world is Koch Industries, the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch. They have been notorious in their funding. In the last decade alone, they've spent over $67 million to basically confuse the public on the issue of climate change. So the second funder, you know, in terms of all-time funding towards the climate change denial campaign, is ExxonMobil. And Exxon, you know, has tried or at least has given lip service over the years to stop their funding of skeptics and climate change deniers, but they continue to do so. And those two are some of the largest funders and kind of the make up the backbone of that denial campaign. Now, on the front side of it, we have individuals like Christopher Monckton or Tim Phillips, James Inhofe, even a senator from Oklahoma. All these individuals have gone out of their way to really put the focus upon them, getting on Fox News, sometimes CNN, and really with the purposeful goal of causing doubt, creating doubt about the issue of climate change. None of these individuals have a scientific background. They're not climate scientists. But Fox News will routinely put them on the air, sometimes alone or sometimes next to a climate scientist, to give the viewpoint that there is a debate on the issue. Well, if you ask the peer-reviewed, credible scientists on the issue, they believe there is no debate. The debate is over. There is a consensus that climate change is happening, and, of course, that we need to do something about it. So it's a very powerful campaign, and one that is up until recently, been very potent in convincing the American public, especially, that there's no need to do anything on this particular issue. Thanks to the severe weather patterns that we've seen in the last couple of years with the droughts and the wildfires and, of course, Hurricane Sandy, you know, we couldn't ask for a better time to release this film because public opinion has now come back around to see the logic in the science and ask and pressure their lawmakers into doing something.
As executive producer, Daryl Hannah, I'm sure, played a critical role in terms of the shape of the film, and she's long known as an activist on many issues. What's been the reaction in the premieres that you've had over the last couple of months and with the release of the film on March 8th? What kind of reaction have you had specifically from environmental groups and on?
Widespread support, Scott, widespread support. Greenpeace has got on board. They've been promoting it heavily. Actually, Kurt Davies, the head of research for Greenpeace USA, wrote a blog today on Huffington's Green page talking about the film and praising the film and with the desire of getting the message out there as far as possible. Last night I was at a screening of the film in Santa Monica, California, and did a question and answer session, and there were members of Sierra Club there that had brought a number of people. And we're getting a lot of response from local, you know, smaller, more regional organizations around the United States and even internationally. Very excited about the film, very excited either they've seen it or they want to see it, or how do we get our hands on it? So I think there is an urgency to the issue. There is a very timeliness to the issue. And I think that, you know, for me, one of the goals of the film was first to educate the public on how deceitful the campaign is to deny climate change. But then once we get that message out there, we really have to turn that education into action. And we have to make sure that our Congress people are listening to real scientists and not these industry-paid climate change denialists.
That was Craig Scott Roseborough, director of the new film Greedy Lying Bastards. For more information about the film, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.